Okay, so I had a very long title. I've forgotten exactly what all was in the title, but anyway, it will emerge. So this is a talk about mirror symmetry and various recent attempts to extend some of the ideas from mirror symmetry. It's joint work in progress. With Hans Jokers and Johannes Balcher. And I should say there are two papers that are kind of the beginning of the story, both papers of Balcher. So if anybody wants to look at them, 1206, 1787. And Jefferson, Balcher, 1309-0490. Okay, so the original story of mirror symmetry goes like this. There are pairs of Calabi-Yau manifolds, or more precisely, pairs of families of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So I have Calabi-Yau X and Calabi-Yau Y. For Calabi-Yau X, I'm going to make a certain kind of computation, which is I'm going to let N sub D be the number of rational curves of degree D on X. There are extensions of this where we look at curves of higher genus. By D, I essentially mean some multi-degree, which is measured by all of the possible elements in H lower 2 of the Calabi-Yau manifold. But in my primary example, that's going to be a one-dimensional space, so I'm just denoting it by D. And there is a dimension count that one makes in algebraic geometry, the Calabi-Yau threefolds. There's a dimension count that one makes in algebraic geometry, which says that the expected dimension of the of a rational curve embedded in the Calabi-Yau manifold, of its moduli within the Calabi-Yau manifold, is zero. Now, that doesn't mean that the dimension is always zero. There can be continuous families. In fact, we'll see an example of a continuous family before too long. So then one has to work to produce something that behaves like the number, even when the number is infinite. So there's a well-defined notion by now of what we mean by number of rational curves. So on X, you have the number of rational curves at various degrees, and you make a funny generating series out of them. You take the sum of, you take the sum of N sub D, D cubed, Q to the D, over 1 minus Q to the D. Some kind of funny sum like that. So that's some generating function. And Q, from this point of view, is some formal parameter that's just used in the general generating function. Now, I need essentially as many formal parameters as I have basis vectors of H lower 2 of X that's measuring homology classes. So if you're going to do this in a case where there's more than where the second Betti number, is bigger than one, you'll use a collection of formal parameters. But the formula has that shape. And on the other hand, there's Y, which is another Calabi-Yau threefold, and we're near some boundary point in the moduli space, and Z is a coordinate near the boundary point. And again, if the moduli space had more than one dimension, I would need a collection of those z's. And what I calculate over here is I calculate periods. These are often denoted. Okay, so the style of calculation I'm talking about was first done by Candelas, De La Osa, Green, and Parks. In 1991, And they introduced, they used a symbol whose existence I was unaware, before I ever saw this paper. It's var pi. So many of us, sorry for the tech excursion. Many of us know that phi looks like this, whereas var phi looks like this, okay? And we all, many of us also know that pi looks like this. So what do you think var pi looks like? So they used var pi for periods, so it's pi for periods. Var pi, interestingly enough, looks like this. Some very strange cursive form of the letter pi. So I'm going to have periods, pi. That was all to explain why I was writing this funny thing. Periods, var pi, which are integrals over cycles of omega depending on z. So this omega is a holomorphic 3 form. And what I really should do is put some label on this, right? Because the period is going to depend on which cycle I choose to integrate on. And so as I allow, so that I can choose, when I take a family of these Calabi-Yau manifolds, I'm going to erase all this, family of these Calabi-Yau manifolds, I can, if I vary the parameters, the diffeomorphism type doesn't change, so I can trivialize the homology. Of course, I'm near the boundary, and so one of the phenomena here is that when you're near the boundary, if you sort of loop around the boundary, then you end up doing some kind of interesting transformation to the cohomology, to the homology. So the periods are really multi-valued as functions of z going in. But anyways, in terms of these periods. And so the prescription is that you take, you introduce a new coordinate t, which has the property that log t looks like a ratio of two of these periods. Okay, so I mentioned multivaluedness, so it turns out that one of them is precisely has logarithmic behavior. One has single-valued behavior, one has logarithmic behavior, and so this sort of defines a new coordinate, and then you expand in this new coordinate. Maybe the q is something like e to the 2 pi it, and you have to expand a certain quantity, which looks like the looks like two derivatives of the holomorphic 3 form, wedged with the holomorphic 3 form again, integrated over the entire manifold. So you expand that quantity in this parameter, and what the guys told us was that these two expansions are equal, which is just outrageous and remarkable and everything you'd like. So this was the original mirror symmetry story. It involved comparing period integrals on one Calabi-Yau manifold or some quantity that you manipulated out of period integrals to counting of rational curves on another Calabi-Yau manifold.
So is that why are compact or not?
Those are compact Calabi-Yau manifolds.
Those are compact.
Yeah. So in the famous case of the quintic threefold, the answer is, so there's a constant term that goes in here, which I forgot to say, but anyway, there's a constant term, 5 plus 2875 Q plus 609250 times 2 cubed Q squared over Q squared minus 1 plus 317206. 375, 3 cubed Q cubed over Q cubed minus 1, plus and so on. So at the time that this original, in 91, when this original thing was done, this number 2875 was calculated by Schubert in the middle of the 19th century. This number 609250, the number of conics on a quintic threefold, was calculated by Sheldon Katz in around 1981. This number was calculated by Ellingsrud and Strama, two Norwegian algebraic geometers, who had heard, I mean, they were sort of experts in doing that sort of thing at the time, and they had heard that physicists were predicting a number, so they calculated a number, and their number was completely different from this number. I like to tell the story because this, to me, is one of the most fortunate mistakes ever made in mathematics. there was this, so what's amazing about the procedure here is that, and we'll review a bit of it in a minute, you can see that the answer has to be a rational number for these coefficients, but there's no reason why it would have to be an integer. So it's already a sort of triumph of the idea that as far as anybody could evaluate this series, the coefficients always turned out to be integers. And so this was supposed to be counting the number of twisted cubics on a general quintic threefold, and the Norwegian guys had done it, and they got a different answer. So that was a situation in the spring of 91, and there was a hastily convened three or four-day workshop at MSRI to sort of talk about this in May of 91, and it had half physicists, half mathematicians. And because there was a discrepancy in the answer, everybody listened to each other carefully, which normally they don't do. That's why it was a fortunate mistake. The end of the story is less spectacular. So anyway, at this meeting, the physicists convinced each other that they were doing things correctly. The mathematicians convinced each other that they were doing things correctly, and nothing was solved. But after the meeting, Alexander and Stroma, so everybody had agreed that their method was great, and it was completely correct. But they had implemented the last step using a computer program, and what they realized over the summer was that there was one subroutine where a counter was initialized at zero, and later it was assumed to have been initialized at one, or vice versa. And when they fixed that little problem in coding and reran it, they got this number. So this is the number. Herb Clemens sent a bunch of people an email whose subject line was, "Physics wins." and nobody saved it. We can't find it. It's really frustrating. It would be nice to actually have it. But anyway, that's what it said. I got a copy of it, so I know. All right, so that was the story of the quintic threefold. So we make this funny calculation. And so how do we make the calculation in practice? In practice, what you do
Dave, you have a quick question.
Sure.
You wrote differently. So here you use 1 minus q to the d in the denominator.
Sorry.
That's just
a mistake. And here, I forgot the 1 minus q. Thanks. And this is square.
Okay.
That's the right one. I should say that these numbers that I'm writing down are now called Gopakumar-Vafa invariants, or sometimes Donaldson-Thomas invariants. The numbers, the first rigorous mathematical definition of the numbers changed what they meant, and we've got things called Gromov-Witten invariants, which are about counting maps from P1 to X rather than counting images of maps, and so there's a slight technical difference. But there are formulas which go back and forth between these counting numbers that we were originally discussing and the Gromov-Witten invariants themselves. So those are not quite Gromov-Witten invariants. So how did the calculation go? Well, the basic idea was to take that expression of integrating the holomorphic form over a cycle and find a differential equation which those periods satisfy. And so, for example, in the case of the quintic, we'll have a specific family of quintics. I'll write it down in a minute. But in general, what one would want would be a differential operator or a collection of differential operators called Picard-Fuchs operators, which have the property, well, if you apply them to the family, because of the local trivial nature of the topology, you could do the integration under the integral sign. And so you want an operator which gives something exact here. And so the integral will be zero. So that gives a differential equation or a collection of differential equations which the periods must satisfy. And if you do it carefully, you can find a sort of minimal set of differential equations which the periods satisfy, and then solve those differential equations. So instead of trying to do the integral explicitly, you find a differential equation which annihilates the answer, and then you can use, in some nice cases, you can use sort of classical techniques to analyze those answers. So the family of quintics, so-called mirror quintics, which people look at, has an equation, x1 to the fifth plus x2 to the fifth plus x3 to the fifth plus x4 to the fifth plus x5 to the fifth. For anybody who's worried, I know my shoe is untied. I'm not going to trip over it. So I take that family, and then typically the parameter that's used is 5 psi to the minus 5. Okay, these are just kind of habit from what people have done forever, to use that family in that particular choice of parameter. And in that case, the Picard-Fuchs operator has a very explicit expression, theta to the fourth minus 5z times 5 theta plus 1, 5 theta plus 2, 5 theta plus 3, 5 theta plus 4, where theta is z d by dz, the logarithmic derivative. So it's almost homogeneous in the logarithmic derivative except for this 5z term. So that operator kills all the periods. You can then do series expansions near z equals 0, which is the expansion point we care about. And you can, it's this equation does not have regular singular points. All these z's, there are too many z's here, and they have to somehow be cleared out. Sorry, it has regular singular points, but it's not. It has singularities at z equals 0. And you discover that there is one regular solution, one logarithmic, one log squared, and one log cubed solution. So we get this family of multivalued solutions with a very predictable behavior by analyzing this differential equation. Okay, that's the classical story of mirror symmetry. Now, about 5 years later, the physics behind mirror symmetry got kind of enhanced, and something called open mirror symmetry was introduced. So what was realized, so there's an underlying string theory here, string theory story, and the string theory story takes either the type 2A or 2B theory on X and compares it with the opposite theory on Y. Those are two kinds of string theories, 2B and 2A. And what was realized in around 96 was that there's a possibility of putting in some kind of other cycle inside the Calabi-Yau manifold on which images of strings could end. So this is now, so the sphere was supposed to have been the image of a string world sheet, a propagating string, which was a closed string, but now we're going to have open strings so they can have boundaries. And in the open mirror, the problem would be to find holomorphic disks ending on Z. And then I have to somehow imagine what's going to go on the other side of this story. So for holomorphic disks ending on Z, the types of Zs that we want on this side of the story are what are called special Lagrangian submanifolds. Special Lagrangian submanifolds have a cool property that the, so here, let me just emphasize that this was omega sub y, but over here there's also an omega, and if I take omega sub x and take its, imaginary part and restrict it to z, it's identically zero. So among the predictions of mirror symmetry are that Calabi-Yau manifolds should have lots of these things and that they should correspond, according to Concevich's homological mirror symmetry conjecture, that these which determine elements in the so-called Fukaya category should correspond to coherent sheaves, or rather classes of coherent sheaves in the bounded derived category of coherent sheaves on Y. So I'm not going to explain that statement. I'm just saying it. At a more practical level, one could imagine generating functions here. So I would take a generating function for these holomorphic disks of degree D. And I'm going to be less precise about the nature of the generating function this time. There are still some debates about exactly what has to go into make this is degree D. To make the generating function story work. And over here, there's one version which says that it, the boundary conditions. So here it's clear what boundary conditions mean. I just have rational curves going in and some kind of boundary. Here I have to say what the boundary conditions for the string theory are. And this is the one where mathematicians have really taken an initial idea and run with it and gotten really abstract answers. So the boundary conditions have something to do with the bounded derived category of the coherent sheaves on Y. In physics terms, sometimes this has to do with so-called matrix factorizations for the equation. And when it can be written in terms of matrix factorizations for the equation, at least in a certain class of cases, it's shown to correspond to algebraic cycles which are homologous to zero. So the first case where this was worked out in any kind of detail was done first by Walcher, and then the interpretation was extended by, I guess you're not supposed to write your own name, by myself and Walcher in around 2008. 2007, something like that, and the interpretation, so we took a particular Z, which was a real quintic inside of the complex quintic, and one should take it to be connected. So there is, when you start to do real algebraic geometry, the number of components becomes an issue. We'll just take it to be connected. And it turns out that the topology of such a thing is diffeomorphic to RP3. And this is one of the few cases, the real locus of the set of defining equations, one of the few cases where one can verify that it's actually special Lagrangian. One of the problems with this extension of mirror symmetry to include open strings is that we have very few sources of special Lagrangian submanifolds, but the set of real points is one of those things. So that was great. And then over here, there's a Picard-Fuchs version of the story, and the Picard-Fuchs version of the story says this, that the Picard-Fuchs equation operating on a replacement for the period, which Walcher likes to call tau of z, is actually a non-zero function of z. So he initially inferred the properties of that non-zero function of z by looking at the properties of the open string theory that he was studying, and then just from the properties that determined it up to basically a constant, and then he was able to solve the inhomogeneous Picard-Fuchs equation to get an answer. And what we did together was we gave a Hodge theory style interpretation of this part of the story, so why that Picard-Fuchs operator gave a particular value. And we did it by relating the boundary conditions to a particular algebraic cycle homologous to zero. So on the mirror quintic, we found two rational curves, C plus and C minus, which were actually conics, on Y, with the property that C plus minus C minus is homologically trivial. So that means that there is some three-chain, capital gamma, whose boundary is the difference of those cycles. So I can imagine C minus and C plus, and then I kind of connect them by a three chain. And the Hodge theoretic quantity to consider was what we might call the integral from C minus to C plus of omega of Z, or more precisely, that's really not a good way to write it. That's not a good way to write it. I should just say the integral over gamma of omega z, where now I have a chain rather than a cycle. So what happens when I do that? Well, if I were to apply the Picard-Fuchs operator to this guy and compare to what happened if I applied Picard-Fuchs to gamma plus little gamma, where little gamma is a cycle, then I would get the same answer, right? Because the Picard-Fuchs operator annihilated all of the periods. So there's some common answer that is independent of the choice of three chain that I use here, and which is actually going to determine, you know, the properties of the generating function according to Welcher's earlier computation. So for this particular case, we had our conics very explicitly, and we actually had fun. I'll admit that I'm the one who had the fun of explicitly calculating. So this time we didn't have any differential equations story to help us, explicitly calculating what happened when you evaluated the Picard-Fuchs operator on that integral. And we got an answer, and the answer was the same that Welcher had sort of guessed from the defining property. So that was very satisfying. And it leads to a general class of examples of this kind, where you would hope to have a special Lagrangian submanifold over here, and you would hope to have a cycle that's homologous to zero over here, so a three-chain gamma with boundary of gamma, a combination of algebraic cycles. And this is a generalization to higher dimension of the famous Abel-Jacobi map, which works for Riemann surfaces. So if you have a Riemann surface and two points on the Riemann surface, P minus and P plus, then you could do a similar trick. You can take the difference and write the difference as the boundary of some, I'm running out of letters, delta, and then you can integrate the one form over delta and get a point in the Jacobian. It's well-defined only up to periods, right? So if you shift delta by an actual cycle, not a one chain, then you're supposed to be getting the same. You're looking for something which is invariant under that shift, so it naturally lives in the Jacobian of the curve, right? And so this is the analog where you're thinking of taking two one cycles on a threefold, and their difference is the boundary of a three chain, and then you get a point in what's called the intermediate Jacobian of the threefold. So we're going to wind up with an integral naturally thought of as being z in the intermediate Jacobians of z. So I mentioned that it's hard to find special Lagrangian submanifolds, but it's much easier to find interesting homologically trivial algebraic cycles. So the two papers that I had listed at the beginning are papers that study cases of interesting algebraic cycles, and the one I'll focus on for today, and as advertised, I'll be giving occasional lectures on this general theme. The various meetings and travel mean that they're happening rather infrequently, but I'll be giving them over some period of time. And I think eventually I'll do some other examples too, but I'm going to be focusing on one particular example where you can write down an interesting homologically trivial algebraic cycle and carry out the information about the what point in the Jacobian you would get. As I'll describe, you're going to get something in the limiting intermediate Jacobian. And it has a number of properties that are sort of surprising. But ultimately, one of the goals is to use properties of this calculation to somehow predict something about the special Lagrangian submanifold. So in the first example, that special Lagrangian submanifold as a topological space was RP3. In general, it's going to be a compact 3-manifold, and there are lots of hints that the calculations that we've done on this side are leading us to guess a particular 3-manifold, but we don't know how to actually make that guess yet. We're just seeing a lot of, as you'll see, it's kind of vague, but we're seeing a lot of things pointing us towards being able to make a guess, but we can't quite make the guess.
Okay, so Dave, can I ask a question now?
Yeah.
So first, is this a generalization to the case x, y are non-compact?
No. Well, x is still compact, but it has a special Lagrangian cycle, and so the string world sheet is going to be non-compact. It'll be a non-compact Riemann surface with a boundary on z. So z is fixed, and I want things with the boundary
on z. But nobody tried, or it just does not make any sense if x is non-compact?
Okay, there are versions of this story with non-compact X. The versions of this story are a little tricky because we don't have such rigid control over, for example, what the holomorphic forms are. So, If it's not compact, well.
Well, I can tell you why I want a non-compact.
Okay.
I just want to take the three manifold and take the tangent bundle.
Right.
There you have an obvious Lagrangian.
Right. I completely agree, but I don't have something like compact curves to count in that setting.
The second question is, can you quickly, you know, tell like us, you know, what is really known mathematically rather than physically? Like, you know, the classical mirror symmetry, what has been proven, what has not been proven?
Okay, so in the classical mirror symmetry, if I have a Calabi-Yau threefold, n-fold, which is a complete intersection in a complete intersection of hypersurfaces in a toric variety, then the number of, the Gromov-Witten invariance of that guy, which is a modification of the number of curves, can be rigorously evaluated through an algorithm, which is the same algorithm you would use if you thought you were doing the Hodge theory on the mirror.
Okay.
So that's the way to say it mathematically.
Okay.
So there's no mathematical connection between the X and the Y. That's the famous mirror theorem about whose authorship there continues to be a lot of dispute. There are two proofs in the literature, and the priority is what's in dispute, somehow, even though they're separated by 2 years. I'm not going to tell that story with the recording device on. The computation that we made last spring is the analog. Oh, I need to tell you what the family that we're going to work with. So we're going to work with lines on the mirror quintic. There's the mirror quintic. And I should have said here that this was a hypersurface. It looks like I'm just doing a quintic, but I'm actually supposed to mod out the ambient space by Z5 cubed and then resolve singularities. So there, for the purposes of the Hodge theory computation that was done before, those two steps really didn't matter, but that has to be done. So lines on the mirror quintic. So these are lines that were observed by a guy named von Heyman. And the von Heyman lines look like this. It's Dutch, and you have to choke yourself to say his name. So you look for solutions to these equations. Of course, I'm going to be able to permute x1, x2, x1 through x5 and get different collections of von Heyman lines, but this plus permutations is what we get. So this is a line on the mirror quintic if and only if a, b, psi is the parameter, is 6, and a to the fifth plus b to the fifth is 27. So this gives too many lines on the quintic threefold, in the sense that we know there are 2875 lines, and if you count carefully, you discover that, if you look at it on the quintic and you count carefully, you discover that you've just written down more than 2875 lines. And so that implies that there's actually a continuous family of lines, and it's known that this actually is part of a continuous family of lines. But this is the discrete set that he originally wrote down. Right? I mean, here, there's just a discrete set of solutions to these two equations, so we get a discrete set of lines, but they're part of a continuous family. So I can take one of these von Heyman lines with omega, and I can take the line with omega squared, where I simply, omega was a Cupid unity, by the way, where I'm just replacing omega with omega squared in this whole story, and those turn out to be homologous, but not algebraically equivalent. So this is my algebraic cycle homologous to zero. And essentially what I'd like to do is write this as the boundary of some three chain, and then evaluate omega z over the 3 chain. And that turns out to be extremely difficult. In fact, what we're going to be interested in is something like the limiting value as z goes to 0 of this guy. And that limiting value, through this earlier work of Walscheid and collaborators, turns out to have the form, so this was conjectured to be equal by Walscheid and collaborators. Okay, I do apologize. I'm going to interrupt myself because I forgot to say something in the closed string case, which is now staring at me on the piece of paper. So back in the closed string case, I'll come back to that sentence in just a minute. Back in the closed string case, there's one really interesting feature of these periods. So you can take the periods and actually, so the periods are integrals of omega. You can also do I think I want to say it this way. You could take these periods and you could take the single value period and you could do a similar thing to what I just described. You could ask, what is the behavior of the single value period as z goes to 0? Now you have to normalize things correctly to see this effect, but the answer turns out to be 200, in the case of the quintic, zeta of 3 divided by 2 pi I cubed. And not coincidentally, 200 is the topological order characteristic of Y. So there's a general phenomenon that you get all in these periods. You get from solving the differential equation, you have a couple of unknown constants in solving the differential equation, and those constants tend to be innocuous things, but one of them turns out to have this really strange behavior. That in order to make the differential equation work and satisfy all the boundary conditions, you end up with this zeta of 3 floating around someplace. And I'll just say as an aside that a few years ago, with some other physics collaborators, we related this to a general feature of perturbative string expansions for Calabi-Yau manifolds. And for a Calabi-Yau fivefold, you might get a zeta of 5 term. You also might get a zeta of 2 times zeta of 3 term. There's some really interesting topology just coming out of those particular limiting quantities. So what I'm going to talk about today is the analogous limiting quantity in the open string case. And the conjecture in this particular case that we're discussing that Walscheid made is that it has lots of different forms you can write it. But one of the forms is 195 root minus 3 over 2 pi cubed times an L function of 2 with respect to a quadratic character that got written on this page, minus 3, this is the Legendre symbol, minus 3 blank. Okay, the blank there is the variable in the Legendre symbol. So that L function is playing the role of the zeta of 3. In the closed string case. And there's a close connection somehow to the field Q root minus 3. In fact, when you go through the most naive extension of the prescription for extracting numbers of disks ending on this thing, you discover that the supposed numbers are actually integers in Q adjoined root minus 3 instead of integers. And okay, so that I mentioned that we don't know exactly what the prescription is. Obviously, there's some trace to do. There are going to be ways to get integers out of this, but we want to understand the connection to the number theory somehow. And I should also mention that this has been carried out at this level of detail for 4 or 5 examples, and you get a different number field in each case. So there are number fields associated to these particular Hodge theory problems. And so, like I said, this was conjectured sort of amazingly on numerical grounds. So what I want to explain for a few minutes is the computation that we now understand how to do, which verifies this result, and explain also why that computation suggests an interesting connection to three manifolds, which makes us hope that what's going on in that computation is really a guide to figuring out what three manifold is supposed to be in the special Lagrangian mirror of this guy. You know, three manifolds, as at least one person in the room can tell you, have this great property of being characterized by their volume if properly normalized. And so it's not going to be a lot of information to know what the volume of the three manifold is, but if I know what it is, and so I don't know that I can put it in X, I don't know that I can put it in as a special Lagrangian, but that's going to be the natural conjecture if we can figure out what the three manifold is.
I thought you were going to say 195 is some other characteristic.
Okay, 195 we can't explain yet.
Okay.
Well, we're expecting that the 195 shows up in the volume of the three manifold. And so we're kind of looking, we've been looking for months for a three manifold that's got a 195 in its volume.
An expert there.
Yeah, I know. I haven't had a chance to talk to him about it. This is all very vague at the moment. We've been reading your buddy Alan's book, for example, and we can't get it out of the book yet, but we're learning. You could teach us the book, maybe. That would be great. Or maybe you have a better book than you do. I'm not sure. So this is what I'm trying to understand, and the key to understanding it is the realization that so we're hoping that it takes values in the intermediate Jacobian of y, which depends on the parameter z, right? And the point is that the family of intermediate Jacobians, thought of as a family of complex tori over this parameter space, the set of z's, whatever it is, this has singularities in some form as you approach z equals 0. So we have to have a way of completing this. So this is z not equal to 0. We have to have a way of completing this over z. So some kind of closure of the family. And then understand how the limiting value is to be interpreted in terms of that closure. And for that purpose, we need not only maps from the homologically zero part of the Chow group of Y into the intermediate Jacobian. So I should continue to put a Z there. But we somehow need to be able to extend that to the boundary. And there's a beautiful theory of this, which has been worked out by even the green in Candela's Lesser Green Parks might not be the green you think it is. And Kerr, which uses higher Chow groups. So these higher Chow groups were introduced by Spencer Bloch to try to mimic some structure that's present in K-theory back in algebraic geometry. So I'm sort of using this map from algebraic cycles into Hodge theory structures like the intermediate Jacobian, but it's kind of a souped-up version of that. So it uses higher Chow groups. And we should have a whole couple of lectures on higher Chow groups. So I can't even begin to define them in this lecture, but I can sort of show you a little bit about what's involved in the calculation. So I have to take my family here, and I have to blow up the singular locus. And there are actually five blow-ups. So I have y1, which is the first blow-up, and then I have y2, which is another blow-up, and so on, down to y5. I have to keep blowing up in some order. And then I have to lift the von Hayman lines to the blow-ups. And having lifted the von Hayman lines to the blow-ups, I get, then there's a double complex. I only have a few minutes. Can't really do this today. So anyway, I'll just say Lyft von Hayman lines. VG is a great acronym. To the blow up. And you follow the double complex. It's really a spectral sequence. And you end up with some some amazing class. So let me just explain that these higher Chow groups are things that live in somehow the cohomology of Y cross a simplex to the K. And but or you can do it with a cube to the K. And so that cube you represent as a bunch of C stars topologically. And so we need a bunch of classes. There's some functions of two variables, and just as a sort of representative sample, except the printing is so small, I have to take my glasses off to read it. So, for example, there's one piece of this, just to give you the flavor of the type of calculation that has to be done, minus 1 minus u to the fifth, 1 minus v divided by this one there's no reason to try to take a note of if anybody's taking notes because it's going to be impossible. V 1 minus u to the fourth, 1 minus omega squared u, comma, 1 minus omega squared u to the fifth, divided by 1 minus u to the fourth, 1 minus omega squared u, and u. All right, so that's one out of about a dozen components of some object that I chased through some spectral sequence. And each of those components then has a contribution to the Abel-Jacobi map of the image. And the contribution, the Abel-Jacobi map, say, of this component, takes the form of the right. So this is all about regulators in K-theory. There may be a person or two in the room who's heard of regulators in K-theory. And the regulators in K-theory that show up, which are terms that you add up to get to that volume, are Dye logarithms, or more precisely, Bloch-Wigner functions of values. Somehow, it's a Bloch-Wigner function associated to this function with the 1 minus u guys. So the output of this higher Chow machine is to produce an interesting collection of compatible things, which are each together, each one separately contributes a Bloch-Wigner guy, and then the sum of the whole thing, the sum of all of the terms, which is the answer for the whole thing, turns out to be, so aj of the sum of all of these aj terms, turns out to be 2 times 195 I times the Bloch-Wigner function of e to the 2 pi I over 3. And that's essentially equivalent to this form that I told you over here. So we're getting the answer as a sum of terms, each one of which is also one of these Bloch-Wigner functions, which is a natural regulator for K-theory. And the reason that's interesting is that Bloch-Wigner functions also tell you what volumes of three manifolds are. So there are volumes of three manifolds. hyperbolic three manifolds can be built often out of so-called ideal tetrahedra. And those ideal tetrahedra have volumes which are Bloch-Wigner functions, and you add up the volumes of the Bloch-Wigner functions from the ideal tetrahedra, and that gives you the volume of the whole thing. So what seems to be suggested by this computational procedure is that the answer will be the Bloch-Wigner function of something, and moreover, it will be built out of simple pieces, each of which has a Bloch-Wigner function, which you add together, and so that is suggestive, and as I said a while ago, it was going to be vague, that's suggestive of being able to build a three-manifold out of these pieces through the ideal tetrahedron decomposition of three manifolds. Okay, so what have we actually done? We've actually taken a very explicit algebraic cycle on this quintic mirror guy. We've blown up the quintic mirror. We chase through the definition of higher Chow groups, which is needed in order to get a map to an appropriately compactified family of intermediate Jacobians. And by doing that, we're able to evaluate this limiting integral as z goes to 0, and we get a value which is not only itself an interesting number theoretic quantity, but is the sum of other interesting number theoretic quantities which were natural ingredients in the computation. And that summation suggestion suggests the same structure that you might get by calculating the volume of a hyperbolic three-manifold from an ideal ideal tetrahedralization, is that the word? And if so, that three-manifold might be the three-manifold which we're expecting to live inside of X as the mirror. Okay, so there are a lot of moving parts. I think that's all I'm going to try to say for today. I will give other lectures explaining how families of intermediate Jacobians degenerate, how you make computations with what these higher Chow groups are, how you make computations with them. Somebody should give a lecture about the Dye logarithm function and the Bloch-Wigner modification of Dye logarithm and how that's related to hyperbolic geometry. And maybe by that point, we'll have figured out how to do this last step and what the three-manifold is. So I think I will stop there. Yes?
So assume you don't know the hyperbolic three-manifold, but at least can you know the volume of the hyperbolic three-manifold?
It should be this.
But that's the guessing.
What I should have mentioned is that this computation that I'm just describing proves this conjecture. So this is no longer conjecture. Walser had conjectured it somehow based on numerics, but then our computation actually gets the answer. So yes, that should be the volume of our hyperbolic three-manifold. Hyperbolic three-manifolds...
What is the number, by the way?
Pardon?
What's the number, right?
It's 195 root minus 3 over 2 pi cubed times
that's L. Not rough.
That cannot be negative.
What is it? It's 73?
Oh, I see. I do happen to know that.
Rough and
you want to know, you want
a number.
A number?
You have a calculator?
Okay, the number is known, but it's not on any of my pieces of paper.
Well, is it less than 1,000 or is it less than 3?
You want to know? No, I understand. What?
No, but then Dave, I'm not so sure that's the right number. I thought you have an 8 in the denominator before. Before it's 2 pi quantity cubed.
Yeah.
That's probably a parenthesis.
There may be a parenthesis needed.
I think there's a parenthesis. Oh, maybe here there's a parenthesis too. Okay.
Somebody else ask a question while I find the number. If there are any other questions.
I have a calculator.
The limit as z goes to 0 of this single-valued period involved zeta 3, right?
Right.
Is there a way to chase what this limit would correspond to through the mirror and find a formula for zeta 3?
So the explanation for the zeta 3 from the mirror perspective is this perturbative story that I mentioned. It's related to something called the gamma class, which has been introduced independently a few times over the last 10 or 15 years, motivated by what happens in some of these mirror symmetry computations, which, if I don't find this number quickly, I'll just waste time talking about the gamma class for a second. I do want to tell you the number. I have to be able to spell better than that. Okay. This paper is open on my desk in my office, but not here. Okay. It better be in this one. No. Thirteen I, actually. 13.3685610356066367 .. It's pretty big. No, that's part of the problem, right? It's pretty big as hyperbolic free manifolds go. So the number of hyperbolic free manifolds somewhere around there is a little hard to control. So the gamma class is a beautiful story. The gamma class is a beautiful story, which is not a prepared story. So I may or may not be able to get it off the top of my head. So there's this great set of what are called multiplicative characteristic classes, which Herzberg introduced. And a multiplicative characteristic class is determined by a power series that starts with 1. So any power series, maybe it has to converge, I don't remember. But any power series starting with 1 will lead you to a characteristic class. And the way you get a characteristic class out of this, for those who know characteristic class theory, is you use this splitting principle to pretend that the churn roots are all defined. You apply this function to each of the churn roots. You write it in terms of elementary symmetric functions of churn roots, and that tells you an expression of the churn classes. But that's how you get things like the Todd class. So, in fact, one of the key things is the Todd class, or the Todd genus. Todd class of X corresponds to the function. Here's where I'm going to have a slight bit of trouble. And the Abreu genus corresponds to another function, which I also don't quite remember. But I think, one of them is sine, or maybe sinh. Sinh pi x over pi x, something like that. This should be looked up. Right. Now, in the application to string theory, and this really comes from thinking about how the map from K-theory to cohomology might respect formulas like the Riemann-Roch formula that involves these, or the index theorem which involves these classes. When you do that, you end up, in some sense, and this was done first by Mackay, introducing a square root of this class. And so the square root of the class appears in lots of different places. It's there is a square root of a power series that, again, has leading order 1, and so that was a perfectly fine thing to do. But the observation is that there is a better thing to do instead of just taking the raw square root, and that is to use the fact that the sine function, if you did sine x over x, I don't know about the over x, you would get something like gamma of x, gamma of 1 minus x, something like that. There's this great formula from complex, there are pi's someplace. I don't know. I don't remember the formula. That's why I should prepare this instead of just do it off the cuff. There's this great formula where you see that those are poles, right? So this should maybe be. Pardon?
Yeah, the signs in the denominator.
Signs in the denominator, yeah. Or the gamma? Yeah. I don't remember which. Anyway, the point is that you get zeros or poles, half of the integers from the gamma function, and the other half from gamma of 1 minus x. And that corresponds to all the zeros you would want from sine, right? So if you can make sense of this idea, you get somehow a better square root, which is very useful in comparing K-theory and cohomology. And so the gamma class is this guy. And the gamma class naturally, when evaluated on Calabi-Yau manifolds, the first non-trivial term you get, the first difference between the square root and the gamma class, is this zeta of 3 times the order characteristic. Actually, zeta of 3 times the third Chern class, which for Calabi-Yau threefold is the order characteristic. And then you get other higher terms, which are also corrections. Anyway, that's where the zeta 3 comes from. Sorry, that was way too imprecise, but I didn't have my formulas to look up. Yes?
You mentioned you had a real quintic inside a complex quintic as an example of a Lagrangian submanifold.
Yes.
So how does the equation of the what is the equation of the quintic, the real quintic inside the complex quintic?
So I take an equation such as the one there with a real value of psi, such that all the coefficients are real, and then I have the real solutions. That's the real quintic.
So you could do it with any real quintic?
You do it with any real quintic. If I get one that is not connected, then it's not going to be RP3. So the particular calculation that we did was assuming that it was had a connected solution set.
So is that like some way to get examples of Lagrangian submanifolds? Is to take real?
So there's a theorem of Bryant which says if you have a complex quintic which is defined over the reals, so all the coefficients are reals, then the complex Calabi-Yau, I think it's as general as that, complex Calabi-Yau manifold, which is defined over the reals, then its real points are a special Lagrangian submanifold. And that's, I think, the only general construction of special Lagrangian submanifolds that we have. And it almost always produces three spheres, projective spaces, or unions thereof. So, one of the great hopes is that many Calabi-Yaus will have three parameter families of special Lagrangian three tori, and that construction method is not going to produce those. All right, quick.